This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Hindu's In Focus podcast. I'm Zubeda Hamid, your host for today. India announced recently that it has completed the 10,000 Genome Project, a reference database of whole genome sequences from people in India. About 20 institutions were involved in this project. India has a population of 1.3 billion with over 4,600 population groups, many of them endogamous. This project is seen as an important step to find out about genetic variants that are unique to India, to potentially customize drugs and gene-based therapies, to give us answers about certain diseases, and to provide a deeper insight into the population's diversity and into genetic predispositions to diseases that we may have. What are the implications of this genome sequencing? How far does India have to go to reap its potential benefits? What are the ethical concerns around the sharing of this data? Is India well enough equipped to ensure health data privacy for individuals? We delve into these questions and more with Shambhavi Nayak, Head of Research and Chairperson of the Advanced Biology Program at Takshashila Institution. Welcome to the Hindu's In Focus podcast, Shambhavi.
Hi, Zubeda. Hello, listeners. And thank you for inviting me to speak on this really interesting topic.
Shambhavi, to start off with, could you talk to us about the recently completed 10,000 Genome Project in India? Could you explain to us what this is about?
Right. So India has been trying to be front-footed when it comes to genomics technologies, right? So we sequenced the first human genome back in 2006, and ever since then realized that the human genome has so much knowledge and understanding that we can help us with healthcare, that we have been trying to now create a India-specific genome, right? A genome that is representative of Indian populations. And the 10,000 Genomics Project is a start of a really ambitious goal from the Indian government to try to reach that representative sample. So 10,000 it looks like a huge number, but relative to the fact that there are more than a billion Indians, it is quite small. So as I said, this is a first step in trying to understand how the Indian human genome looks like. There were more than 20 institutions that were recruited to sequence genome, collect samples, etc., establish a biobank. And you can understand the requirement for this, right? India has close to 5,000 different subpopulations. And so you want to create a repository that will represent all of these genomic subpopulations. I'm sure we can come to later on what does the whole idea of subpopulation means from a genomics point of view. But I think it's a really great step. It's a step that many other countries are also trying to take. Because we now understand that a lot of human disease and health is derived from the genome. And so the more information we understand about how the genome functions, the better steps we can take on making Indians healthier.
Talk to us a little bit about the population subgroups. As you said, we have over 4,500 subgroups, and we also have a history of endogamy. Does this mean that harmful genetic variants that may otherwise have died out can continue to persist in India?
Right. So this is actually quite interesting because some point of time in our history, about 2,000 years ago, the Indians back then basically decided that they were going to become endogamous, so they were going to intermarry and have children only within definite communities, right? And what has happened because of that, there has been no intermingling between these populations for a long period of time, for centuries. And therefore, whatever genes were present in that subpool has remained in that subpool, including founder genes. So these were genes that were present in the founding members of that group 2,000 years ago and haven't had the chance of being replaced by other incoming mutations or incoming genes. And therefore, you find them very rampant among these signature genes, very rampant among a community. As a consequence of that, both beneficial and genes that cause diseases have remained in that subpool. Now, if it's a rare disorder, then in a bigger population, you would not have noticed it. But because this would have been replaced with a healthier version of the gene. But in this setup, where you are not seeing healthy genes as often, it is likely that a diseased genome will become more frequent and will occur with a larger likelihood in that population. Let me give you an example here. This doesn't come from predictive genomics, but it is a good case study to understand how we now use the information for predictive genomics. So a few years ago, doctors in Andhra Pradesh started seeing this phenomena where members of a particular community were fatally allergic to a certain form of anesthesia. And obviously, doctors really don't like their patients dying on at the hospital bed, right? Especially if the surgery is successful, but they're not recovering from the surgery because they seem to be weirdly allergic to the anesthesia. And through anecdotal evidence, what was built up was it seems to be endemic to this community. Then research showed that these members actually lack a gene that creates an enzyme which is needed to break down the anesthetic preparation. And that this particular community had not seen any external gene flow coming in, so any external gene inputs coming in for 108 generations. And therefore, there was a 100-fold high rate of this gene deficiency in that particular community. So a lot of members of those that particular community are now going to be at risk if you give them that anesthetic. So now doctors from the region ask, if you belong to that community, then you are given another anesthetic so that you don't die because you cannot recover from that anesthesia, right? And this is a very beautiful example of where we first noticed the disease, the symptoms, and then actually could figure out the genetic link. But what predictive genomics is trying to do is now say that, okay, you belong to a certain community. This is how your genetic makeup is. And these are the diseases that you are at risk at. And obviously, because we have not seen external gene inputs coming in, as a member of that community, you are a higher risk of having such a so-and-so mutation.
Do we have a lot of groups like this, do you think, in India?
We do. So even the genetic causes of diseases are different, right? For example, something like thalassemia, you know there's a single mutation, and if you have two copies of genes, so obviously you inherit genes from both your mother and your father. If both genes are diseased or the mutations are bad, you will suffer from the disease, right? But there are also other diseases like BRCA1 mutation. We know it increases the risk of breast cancer. So having a BRCA1 mutation does not mean that you will have breast cancer, but you're increasing the risk, right? And so within populations, we can now start to identify whether genes that cause disease or genes that increase the risk of disease are high. For example, there were studies that showed that in Konkani Brahmins, there is a higher susceptibility to having BRCA1 mutations. So those subpopulations do exist. We know, for example, in tribal groups in Maharashtra and Andhra Pradesh, there is a higher risk for sickle cell anemia. There's a lot more to be discovered. But from the efforts that we have done so far, and anecdotally from what doctors are reporting as diseases, we can see that there's a causal linkage between genetic signatures and disease predisposition. And that's the basis on which I think doing predictive genomics makes sense.
So one aspect of it is to be able to find out, as you said, whether we are susceptible or any particular community is vulnerable to a particular form of disease. Does it also have other real-life direct healthcare benefits, a genomic project like this? Can we make, say, customizable drugs, for instance? And has this happened in any other parts of the world that have larger genome databases than ours?
Right. So there are a lot of efforts going on to make customizable drugs. They are either in clinical trials or not ready yet. I think the low-hanging fruit from predictive genomics is diagnostics, right? Is to have the self-awareness that you might be at risk of a disease, to be able to, as a prospective parent, be able to screen and choose a healthier embryo, do genetic counseling when you're getting married, etc. And there are some really fantastic case studies around this part, right? So for example, there is Dor Yeshurim, which is an organization that looks at Jewish populations. Jewish populations have also been endogamous for centuries, so they also suffer from this phenomena where members of particular Jewish communities are at higher risk of disease. So what Dor Yeshurim does is that it takes blood samples from teenagers when they are in school, and when the boys and girls are ready to marry, they have to basically call into this organization with their number. and they are told whether them and their spouse's signature match. So if both of them have a diseased genes, then they go into marriage counseling, genetic counseling, choose methods of diagnostics, etc., choose IVF and a method to make sure that they are only going to be implanting a healthy embryo. And using this method, actually, in at least two Jewish settlements in the US, Tay-Sachs disease, which is otherwise a completely debilitating genetic disease, has been removed from two Jewish communities in the US. So it does make an impact. It just has to be a sustained effort. There are a lot of ethical concerns that arise out of, you know, taking information, sharing like this. But when done well, it definitely will have an impact. So A, you will have see better diagnostics. B, you will then can start creating customizable drugs. We have just started seeing from this year the first gene editing treatments coming through. That will become easier over time as well. So all of those personalized healthcare based on your signatures will just become, we will drive down cost. We will have much more data on which to base them. So I think there is a huge revolution coming in healthcare based on these platforms.
Talk to us a little bit about specifically about India's project. We are at the 10,000 stage now. Will it get quicker and easier over time? Because I believe the costs also have come down as this technology has progressed, correct?
Yeah, it has. I mean, when the first human genome was sequenced, it cost over $1 billion. And now with current technologies, it costs $1,000. And people are estimated that very soon it's going to be less than $100 to sequence one entire human genome, which is really, as the technology grows, not only are the costs coming down, but the precision with which we can do this, the amount of sample that we require to do this, everything is reducing, which just makes it much more easier to be able to sample human genomes. This, as I said, 10,000 genomes is a really good start. We expect that we will have to at least sequence about 1 million genomes properly sampled across the various subpopulations to be able to create that representative genomic map that we require. The way we can do this, obviously, is do it community-wise, geography-wise, etc. But we already have a lot of institutional buy-in now. So that should get much simpler. The other thing that I think India needs to invest right now is in genetic counselors. Because I know it sounds very nice that, oh, can we now tell whether a particular community is at risk of, say, thalassemia. But the data is not that simple. The way the data is churned up, the way the data is analyzed, and what it actually means for the person at the other end, right? It is not always that simple, particularly when you're looking at, say, BRCA1 mutation. We all remember when Angelina Jolie had that operation because she had a very high risk, a very high predisposition to ovarian and breast cancer because of certain mutations in her body. A lot of doctors were asked, oh, we also have this mutation, should we get surgery done, etc. And that's not the scenario we want to get to. With the correct use of data, we want to help people lead better lifestyles, right? So if you are at a very high risk of diabetes, what can you do? And that is the role of a genetic counselor, has to look at the raw data, look at, you know, understand the context of the individual and then advise on what kind of steps to be taken. So while we focus on getting more samples in, building up infrastructure, which I think we are doing quite well, we also need to make sure that the entire value chain of genetic counseling is fixed and ready for this opportunity.
So speaking about how it can benefit the individual, talk to us a little bit about what you mentioned earlier. What are the ethical concerns surrounding the sharing of such data, and should it be made available, for instance, to the individual who gave his sample?
Right. So let me just take that last question first, right? So I spoke to you about Dor Yeshurim, and I had not realized this before I read about Dor Yeshurim and that story. So Dor Yeshurim does not actually give out any data on the mutations, not even to the person from whose sample they're taking. They don't take name, contact information, nothing. So they just take the sample and they store, they give you a identity marker, like a number, and then you have to call in with the number, right? And one of the guiding principles for them is that you have the right to not know. Because even knowing, for example, if I find out today that I have a BRCA1 mutation, it will impact the way I will live my entire life if I am not informed enough about the context of that BRCA1 mutation and, you know, how at what risk am I really of getting breast cancer because I have that mutation? And that will impact the way I live every day, the way my spouse treat me, the way people treat me, etc. Right? So they actually believe that there should be a right to not know. And so there is a significant amount of question around, particularly when you take data for research, which is what this is, right? So you're taking genomic data for research and you find an anomaly. What is the correct course? And this has, I mean, through clinical trials around the world, this has been a much debated topic. And I think we don't really have a good answer to it. I think if it's a mutation which is definitely going to cause disease, or a bunch of mutations that are definitely going to increase the risk of a disease substantially, then I think the patient has the right at some point of time to be right to information, and whether and the patient should be asked for consent if they want to see that information, right? So that is one kind of an issue that we will see a lot of times that will come up. Second, I think, is about data sharing. One of the main concerns that people have is, as that will be an outcome of predictive genomics, is insurance might go up because people might say that, oh, you are from a community that has a higher risk of this disease. That's publicly available information, so your insurance will go up. And India needs to take a stance on this. And I think the stance has to be that genes cannot be a risk factor in insurance. But that we have to see how that plays out. Third is, and I think the bigger problem is going to be that we are going to start saying, hey, this community has good genes, this community has bad genes, we start screening, etc. And that is a social imposition. That's an imposition of our social fabric, I think, of a social thinking, which can come on science. And that we really need to have more education on. That, again, the context is very important. The risk of a disease should not be held against a person, right? So you can actively make sure that if there are disease mutations, that they do not pass on to next generations, but that should not be held on against a person. So that, I think, is going to be a major concern. And third is obviously privacy and what is identifiable data in this case. So we do not have a strong enough privacy law right now. In one of the earlier drafts of the Data Protection Act, health data and genomics data was supposed to be a part of the actual policy draft, but that has now been removed. So that is currently still an outlier. We do have the health data policy under the health mission, but I don't think that is comprehensive enough to cover all the issues that arise because of using health data. And that's what is identifiable is really interesting because your genes can tell you a lot about the person. And we are still, I think, scratching on what information we can get out of it. Right? When we started understanding how to sequence data, we have now come up with this treasure trove of information. But I think as technology improves, as our own understanding of what human genes do improve, we are going to be able to extract more and more data out of it. So currently, I can take a DNA sample and using identifiers, and as long as I have the sample of a suspect or a victim, this is commonly used in forensics, we can identify a human being, right, with a certain probability score. I think that is just going to get easier and easier. So what is identifiable in health data is an outstanding ethical question that needs to be answered.
You spoke a little about the potential for discrimination, for instance, through insurance, or maybe if your workplace knows you're susceptible to a particular disease, they might not be too interested in hiring. Or I could see this impacting women also in terms of marriage prospects if they say, you know, this particular community's people have this particular gene. So what do you think is required in terms of legislative policy? As you just pointed out, we do not have the greatest of records with protecting personal health data. Do we need specific guidelines or a framework for this?
Yes, and I think particularly for health data, it has to be law. So in the life sciences, we see a lot of guidelines and policies which are not always enforceable. And so litigation around that is very low. And what we need here is protection of human rights, right? So I think there has to be a law. There has to be a much, much more stringent debate on what is, as I said, identifiable data. What happens to human data how is it shared between entities within India and entities from outside India, if that has to be the case. I think there's a bit more clarity on sending data abroad, but even within India, we need to have more stringent laws around that. We need to have a law around which is similar to the US GINA law to protect against discrimination based on, by insurance at least, based on genetic risk. And we need a lot more awareness to be raised, right? This might not everything can be solvable through law or policy, but particularly directed efforts on educating people on what it means to be at risk of a disease, and that it doesn't actually inform much about the person. I think it's important because there are, I think the Human Genome Project, and even this predictive genomics, thalassemia, sickle cell anemia, cancer, etc., are very low hanging fruits and something that we understand. But scientists have been trying to find genes that are linked to aggressiveness, for example. And that is then a little scary territory, because if a particular community is then shown to have the gene linked to aggressiveness, then that can have real life repercussions for them for finding jobs, etc., right? What kind of information should be shared? What are the diagnostics or treatment avenues that can be raised? Does it make sense to share all of this data? There has to be some real conversations around what that means. So just, I understand that there is a trade-off here. The more data you get, the better it is for companies, for agencies, for scientists to develop products, right? But the more information you get, you also risk getting all of these other points which you might not want to be out in the open. So I think that trade-off has to be discussed in further detail.
You mentioned a little earlier about companies from abroad being able to access data. Do we need strengthening in that mechanism? For instance, if pharmaceutical companies from abroad are accessing data belonging to Indians and then, say, manufacturing drugs based out of that data, is there some sort of regulation that needs to be in place for this?
Yeah, so this is a very tricky field because we already have some guidelines about sharing of human data from India abroad. It is not always enforced or monitored correctly, so we do need capacity there. But at the end of the day, I think we have to figure out how much does this actually account for, because Indian diaspora is present everywhere, right? So an US company, if it doesn't get access to Indian data, might just be able to use American Indian citizens to get sort of similar data, right? So it is not that data is exclusive. So the Indian genome is exclusive now to India anymore. So we have to count for that. And hence it is important that we make our own efforts, right? Because tomorrow, if an American company comes and says that we have found a cure for we have patented a cure for a disease that is endemic to 5 communities in India, and we have not done it so far, I think it's our loss. So more than having regulations that kind of regulate the sharing of data, I think we need to make sure that we have that front-footedness when it comes to using these technologies and discovering for ourselves where the Indian genome can be strengthened.
A lot of this, what we talked about just now, a lot of this, as you said, is predictive, right? So you can't say, like for instance, with the breast cancer thing, you can't say 100% one way or another that it will happen, correct?
Right.
And that sort of awareness is also important, that it may or may not happen?
Yes. Because we don't want people to be spooked into taking steps or leading lifestyles that they would otherwise not have. Because really, a lot is risk-based. There are some monogenic diseases where we know that if both of the genes that you have are diseased, you will have the disease. And those, I think, are pretty straightforward. But for a number of diseases, it is increasing risk potential. And so what you need to do to be able to prevent that outcome is something that you and the genetic counselor needs to figure out. It cannot be headline news. It cannot be, oh, I have BRCA1 mutation, so that's it. I'm going to not change the entire way I eat or everything. It has to be more informed. It has to be more nuanced than that. So I think we need to have that genetic counseling thing to be set up and ready.
Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Shambhavi.
Thank you, Zubeena. Thank you to all the listeners.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.